Thursday Night Football with John Giles.
Johnny Giles is a national treasure. When he speaks, I mean, I'm like, yes, yes, yes. When he's on the show, I was in the car the other day. I parked the car and I sprinted into the house and turned on the radio. I love listening to him. I love Johnny Giles.
John Giles, every Thursday at 7:30 p.m. on OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Oh, wow! In your life, have you seen anything like that?
I'm a very confident front runner for Kelly for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello there. You're very welcome along to Golf Weekly. It's great to have you with us. We are excited. Golf is back. I mean, this is an amazing thing. Golf is back. The PGA Tour resumes. We are looking forward to the Charles Schwab like we have never looked forward to the Charles Schwab before. We will later on be talking to Andrew Coulthard, Ryder Cup player, two-time winner on the European Tour. Was on the European Tour for a long time, 1993 through to 2010. He was on the European Tour. And now we know him, of course, on Sky Sports. Beautiful Scottish voice, Sean Connery-esque vibe to Andrew Coulthard, I always think. Now, alongside me, we have, from his driving range, some serious noise coming from your driving range, I think, Peter.
Yeah, that's John next door, John Dignam. He does all the club repairs, and he's been flat out. So excuse the drilling noises and stuff like that. But for all you golfers out there who need to get their clubs repaired, and there's plenty of them, they've been throwing them into John, and he's been working away.
Very atmospheric, you know. I mean, people would pay a huge money for the production values of a working driving range behind them as they record a golf podcast. So this is very welcome. We can make do with that. Once we know what it is, I mean, that's once you know what it is, it's okay. And Fionn Davenport with his, get ready, everybody. Get ready. Your ears are in for a treat because Fionn Davenport has gone out and purchased very nice professional microphones. So you're about to hear his dulcet tones in a very, very full way, I would think. Hello, Fionn.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing?
Oof.
I know. Well, I
almost
did.
Sensual, Peter, is it not?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Reminds me of the radio station that we used to go to.
Yeah,
to
indeed.
To record this.
Yes, indeed. And still will, again, at some point.
Yeah. Maybe so. Is this now your podcasting HQ, Fionn? Is that what we have here?
So what I've done is, I just, for the nerds, for the tech nerds, I just made sure that I could use, like, relatively broadcast quality equipment, because I want to, just for interviews, for doing my own podcasts and radio pieces, etc. So rather than have to go into a studio to record them, I can record them here at home if the sound, the ambient sound allows.
That's very nice. I'd give yourself another inch to the mic. You were peaking a touch.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'd say you could go to a distance. And meanwhile,
this has to be the only podcast where we solve things online, right?
Yeah, well, we break down the fourth wall here.
If you could stick your head into your man next door and tell him to ease off on the drilling for the next 2 hours, that'd be just dandy with us. I'm sure he'd welcome that feedback. So, I mean, look, this is surreal in a way, isn't it? Golf is back. This is exciting. There's no two ways about it. It's a Thursday morning. I know the featured groups are going out. I'm really looking forward to this. I have to say, I'm just unashamedly excited to have this back. And my other half said to me yesterday that she's going to see her friends tomorrow evening, Friday. She's like, so what are you going to do? And in my head, I said, out loud, I said, I don't know. But in my head, I said, I know exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to be watching the feature group of Rory McIlroy, Brooks Koepka, and John Rahm playing Colonial. This is, are we excited, Fionn? I feel like we are.
I'm definitely excited. I mean, They're no fools. They have created a package that features four marquee groups. Like, there are four tee times that are just terrific. Justin Thomas playing with Ricky Fowler and Jordan Spieth. You've got Rory playing with Brooks and John Rahm. Are they 1, 2, 3 in the world? Is that, am I right? And then you've got DJ with Justin Rose and Bryson DeChambeau, which, you know, is of interest. And then you have Kevin Na, Gary Woodland, and Phil Mickelson together.
Quick mention of Justin Rose, because we're not going to touch on him again across the podcast. He is well down the betting. It's even the novelty of looking at betting odds again for a golf tournament. But he is right down there. And it's because, obviously, of his equipment situation. And he has now left that fancy Japanese...
Honma?
Yeah. So, I don't know, Peter. I mean, I'm very curious. I was looking at Justin Rose and I was thinking, I wonder. You know, sometimes when a golfer psychologically leaves something like bad equipment behind him, which has been dragging him down mentally, and he gets the old feel of his old clubs, and suddenly his confidence could go from floor to sky high, feeling absolutely great about life. Now, equally, he may struggle to get out of the weeds and figure this whole thing out again, but very curious to see if Rose makes a quick recovery when he gets the, oh, this feels familiar again. That could happen very quickly for a golfer.
Yeah, I think he'd be back practicing quite a bit with his old equipment or with new equipment that he's much more comfortable with. So I think you're right. I think being so far down the betting this week is a surprise, and it also give him a an outside chance. So he's probably worth maybe a tenner each way.
Oh, hang on, a euro each way. Let's gamble sensibly, for God's sake. We're not throwing. Sorry, not in the business throwing tenors each way on long shots. That's not how.
I'm just used to those tenors coming in for large baskets. You know.
Right. Okay. So, well, that's Rose. Look, I'm really interested to see how he goes, because it's bizarre the way his game has fallen apart. They're tasty feature groups, Fionn. I think the McIlroy one is out early today, so they'll be out Friday evening for people.
Yeah. So they're out at whatever it is, 2 o'clock. Texas time, so yeah, that'd be early doors, so they'll be out as we're talking. And but actually 10 minutes before, Justin Thomas, Ricky Fowler and Jordan Spieth. So you have two groups that are going out back to back, and they're the ones really to follow. They're the ones that seem like where all the action's going to be. I'm excited because we haven't had golf for 3 months, and my appetite, like many others, was whetted by the match between Phil, Tiger and the boys a couple of weeks ago. And I guess more than anything else, it just says, ooh, okay, well, the sporting landscape is approaching something like a familiar sight than it has done for, well, what seems an inconceivable amount of time.
Yeah.
Guys, I think it's going to be a pleasure to watch. You're actually going to hear proper strikes. While you'll hear no gallery noise because there's no galleries there, but you're actually going to hear the pure strike of each of the golf clubs that they're hitting. So it really could be a the way forward here without galleries. While John does some drilling here in the background.
There is.
The irony of you talking about the clean noise as John drills over your words is quite something. We're going to have to talk about this during the week. We're going to have to find a slightly different room for you, my friend, I think.
Yeah, well, look, you switched the time on me, you know what I mean? So that was the problem.
On Colonial and the type of tournament we're going to get. So this is this is the greatest Charles Schwab in the history of Charles Schwabs. They've never had a field like it. I think they've never had the world number one and two in the same field. They've never had they have all the world's top five now. Basically, it's off the scale. Jeff Magger.
Well, here proves the point. Mm. If you ever go back to appearance money, this proves the point that if there's less tournaments, no appearance money has to be paid, because guys will play in anything to play golf against each other. So when we go back to the days of Seve, Faldo, Lyle, Nicholas Watson, when they all played in the same tournaments, there was no appearance money. It was just, there was very few tournaments. But they had to play in.
Would we want to go back to that, really? Like, do we not quite like having a PGA Tour event every week to watch?
I would love to go back to a minimum amount of tournaments. And golf would not be then such a overdosed. And people would actually look forward to it far better.
Okay. The thing is, Peter, is that until the 90s, most golf tournaments weren't televised, or a lot of golf tournaments wouldn't have been televised. So you would have read about it in the paper, and, you know, these great rounds would have been witnessed only by those there. So, I mean, with saturated TV and with every single shot of golf available to you from the comfort of your own couch comes the issues of, people competing for who's going to play in what tournament, and then you have Sky paying money, you have CBS paying money, whatever, and then you have the issue of appearance fees. So,
but each tournament is diluted substantially. Yeah.
Well, not every, it's true. I mean, you can put it kindly and say, it's not every tournament is that interesting. But if you wanted to feed a golf, like, you know, for four nights a week, most weeks of the year, you can watch it if you want.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. It's interesting, though, is that the tournament director at Colonial, so his name is Michael Toth, if I'm pronouncing his surname correctly, he's expecting massive TV ratings. The quote is, "It won't be the best ever in golf because we don't have Tiger in the field and he drives everything, but I think we'll do a 6.0 or higher." And that's Toth referring to the Nielsen ratings. And he says, "If we had Tiger, we could do a 10. So I had, and worth considering, the Colonial has never drawn better than a 2.0. And just to give you an idea, okay, the last time golf had a 10 or over 10 rating was the 2010 Masters, when Mickelson won the third Masters and fourth major. Tiger finished fourth. You want the highest Nielsen rating for golf, you have to go back to 1997 and Tiger's first win. It got a 14.1, which translates as 20.3 million viewers.
Wow.
So, yeah, there you go.
How does the Nielsen metric work, Fiona? Is that a percentage of the audience?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, it's a bit like, if I'm now, I'm going back to how I they might have altered it, but they have a selection of viewers that then have a box. They're fitted with a box that where it just monitors their viewing habits, mm-hmm. and then they extrapolate a percent, you know, a number from that. So they have it spread across demographics, age groups, gender spread, et cetera, and that's how they create the Nielsen rating. What certainly was the way they used to. I mean, it might have amended, and forgive me if I'm not up to speed. But yeah, so I mean, but we're talking, I mean, compared to other sports, I mean, golf still remains like a niche. When you have 20.3 million people watching the Masters in 1997, that's that's NFL. Well, maybe not quite NFL numbers, but it's pretty up there.
Things about this tournament, it's not a tournament the Bombers would necessarily have picked. I think the next three PGA Tour events are not necessarily Bombers' paradises. So Colonial, a lot of fairways run out, a lot of non-driver shots off the tee. And as well, Peter, the greens there are known to be fairly exceptional. We'll have lots of long putts going in because they run incredibly true. So I think Justin Ray, the statistician, brilliant statistician on Twitter, had pointed out that generally the winner here, their strokes gained putting margin over the field is often greater than in other events. The really good putters can separate themselves more from the average at this event. Okay. So for instance, I mean, look, I hesitate to say this because I'm talking about the world number one who can win anywhere, but it's not necessarily somewhere you'd say, oh, well, that's made for Rory and that will give him a chance to, you know, for instance, exert his dominant driving over the field. So it's an interesting course in that way. I mean, I quite like increasingly watching the Hilton Heads of the world, the Colonials of the world, where it's not necessarily driver off the tee. So that's what we can expect at Colonial.
Which is wonderful, isn't it? You're actually going to see some shot making.
Yeah.
You're not going to see bombers, you know what I mean, jump out of their boots to hit driver. You're actually going to see guys who work it around the golf course quite well. You know, for me, as that type of player, it's only wonderful to see. Too many times now, we get to see too many golf courses, new golf courses being built that are bombers' paradises. You know, the next one will be over 8,000 yards long in not too long. So for TV and for guys who like to shape the ball, it's a pleasure to watch.
Mm. Let me give you the field because we have the world's top five and we have 101 PGA Tour winners in this field. It's quite something. So McIlroy leads the odds as favorite. John Rahm is second favorite. Then Justin Thomas. Bryson DeChambeau in the field. I mean, I don't even know what Bryson DeChambeau weighs anymore, but I'm presuming he is ripped. Webb Simpson, who was playing very well before the break, we should add, was back playing very well. Is by all accounts a real shot maker. He's there around 20 to 1. Brooks Koepka, back from his layoff. I mean, this break may have benefited Koepka and Tiger Woods more than anybody else in the game. His knee was not right. He has had a lot of time to fix it now. McIlroy was in incredible form when this break happened, but Koepka and Woods may well have welcomed the break.
Dustin Johnson said as much. I'm playing 1,000 times better than I was.
Okay. Dustin Johnson there about 25 to 1. Patrick Reed is at 25 to 1. We have Ricky Fowler in the field. Xander Schauffele, 28. Mark Leishman is another shot maker at 30 to 1. And then, of course, the man who's going to win, sleeping in his own bed, local boy, Jordan Spieth, 30 to 1. Coming at you, Peter Lawrie. Watch out.
Well, look who he's playing with in the first two rounds.
Who?
He's playing with his best buddy, Justin Thomas.
Yeah, and Ricky.
And Ricky. So if you're ever going to settle into a round, you know, I'll hold up my hands and say Jordan Spieth has a chance this week.
Is there an argument to be made that Justin Thomas is the most popular golfer on tour? Like, he's friends with everybody. Everybody goes, I am a good Tiger.
He
good
reminds Justin me Thomas. Of a Fred Couples, doesn't he? He's kind of got that Fred Couples type attitude.
I just keep harking back to when he won, was it the PGA? And I remember we were talking about it, and you, Joe, we were like, yeah, I just find it so hard to get enthused about Justin Thomas.
We didn't know him that well then.
I know.
I mean, yeah. I still wouldn't say, maybe it's just a personal thing. I still wouldn't say, like, on a Friday, if Justin Thomas was the main feature player, it would have me.
But having,
I must get home and watch that. Although he seems like, look, he's a exceptionally good player, and even his commentary dint on the match, he seems like a great fella. So absolutely nothing against him.
No. Of course not. But doesn't his performance on the match, and where we got to see a bit of his personality, he didn't overforce it. He was just his natural self, or seemed to be. Doesn't that make you kind of all of a sudden keep a keener eye on Justin Thomas in the field? It does for me anyway. Like, I've become a bit of a Justin Thomas fan on the back of that, which really says it's the power of television.
Jordan is out, Fionn, is he?
No, Jordan, he's not. Gone. Listen, Jordan's,
he's
Jordan's
gone.
Jordan is the perennial number two for me. And I'm after Tiger. I mean, is like, in terms of people I'm looking out for. Hey, what about you have the odds in front of you, Joe. What's Shane Lowry at? Because he's going out with Cameron Champ and Jim Herman.
I'm getting to it.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Colin Morikawa is there after Jordan Spieth. He, again, was playing very well. We have 35 to 1 territory, Justin Rose. And then 40 to 1, Matt Kuchar. Sergio Garcia is about 40 to 1 as well. Gary Woodland, US Open champion, about 40 to 1. And then we get into Shane Lowry territory, which is Jason Day. Where is Jason Day? Dear, oh dear. 40 to 1. Matt Fitzpatrick, 41. They have Shane Lowry at 50s. Now, I would have thought a good shot maker like Shane and a good putter on his day, like Shane, might like the look of that, Peter. I guess the unknowable here is, how hard has everybody been practicing? Some players.
Well, Shane has a new caddy on the bag this week for the next 3 weeks. Darren Reynolds has taken over from Bo. Bo's wife is just about to have a baby. So Bo's taken a couple of weeks out. So Darren flew over to the States. Had to do, I think, 2 weeks in quarantine over there because Shane has been over there. So, wish Darren all the best on a very kind of nice way to come into it. You know what I mean? No crowds. And he's been with Shane now for the last, I think, week or so to become accustomed to his game. So, and we read in on the Twitter and whatever else that Shane's been playing quite a bit with Rory and Brooks Koepka. So I like Shane's chances here, to be honest.
Okay.
Do you think Bo is sitting at home going, I really wish Darren well, but not too well.
Not too well. You can't.
I spoke to him all right. And look, like anything, you know, you're just delighted to see your player get back out. And I think Bo would be delighted to be there, but the family comes first.
Point of order, Peter. You can't say on the Twitter.
Can I
not?
No.
You can't also say on the Twitter machine.
It's just Twitter.
Yeah, I just like that. Just
on Twitter. On Twitter.
No, like on the Twitter. Holding it out there as...
You sound like somebody's granddad who's like deliberately misconstruing something to show that, like...
The other day on Twitter, actually.
There you go, on Twitter.
Yeah, I had a rant on Twitter the other day.
So. Did you about? What about?
The announcement of the golf clubs were not allowed to run competitions.
Oh, I did see that.
Last Friday, this announcement came out to say competitions were not allowed.
As in your internal Saturday competition for club members?
Yes, yes, yeah. And all the golf clubs were ready to, you know, start up. And it's a good generator of revenue for the pro and the club themselves when people enter the competitions, the twos and whatever else.
Yeah.
And that was all stopped. It was only social golf allowed.
Was there a specific logic given? I mean, I'm sure it comes under the heading of health and safety generally, but I can't...
It was under the health and safety, but there was a committee set up about all competitions in sport. And they stopped golf, which they stopped all sports, but golf was included in it.
It's hard to see how a competitive game of golf, allowing for the rules, i.e., around the pins and social distancing, but it's hard to see how a competitive game of golf is dramatically different from a social game of golf.
Well, that was my point, and my also point was like. The club has the power to relax some of the rules in relation to signing a scorecards, you know, for a marker to have to sign it and whatever else. But
I
just thought it was wrong, and I had a bit of a rant. So I just felt it was the same here with the driving range. It was people calling the bays, you know, they were indoors and you know they were covered, and you know we shouldn't open the bays, the internal bays, you should just open the grass bays. And that was the Friday before we opened as well. So it was just probably a knock on from that.
Okay.
So I had a rant on the Twitter.
Good. I always think of Justin Timberlake's character in The Social Network turning to Mark Zuckerberg and saying, drop the, just call it Facebook.
Yeah. Indeed.
Can I mention, sorry, and I know I want to touch on the George Floyd situation, Fionn, because it came up again.
Sure.
This week, but I just saw some really sad news, and you really wish him well. Camilo Villegas, a four-time PGA Tour winner, his 20-month-old daughter, so just shy of 2 years old, has tumors in her brain and spine, and is in her second round of chemotherapy, which is just awful news. You can't imagine. His daughter, Mia, underwent surgery. She was diagnosed in early March. She's been treated at the Jack Nicklaus Children's Hospital in Miami. He hopes to have more information, Villegas, about her prognosis very soon. He's hoping, he says, it's just a bump in the road. He's playing on the Corn Ferry Challenge event at Sawgrass this week. He said, you know, his family told him to go out there and play and get back playing. He's had a real fall from grace. He's had a bad shoulder injury the last couple of years. And he was a really top player for a time there, Peter, and, you know, clearly very athletic and agile and was doing yoga, and even the way he would get down and read the greens was quirky. So you wish him well. That's shocking news to see that.
Oh, it's never easy. No, like it's just a terrible thing to have to happen. I remember when my son was being born, Christopher, 6 months before he was being born, we were told that he had a 50-50 chance, and because he had increased ventricles, and to try and play under that, you know, for the next, before he came out of the womb, was horrendous. So I can only imagine what Camilo is going through, having, you know, his child going through, a two-year-old, and it's shocking. It really is. But unfortunately, so many other people are going through this as well, and then trying to work at the same time. So sometimes we forget that there's world outside of golf and what the players have to go through. And sometimes you wonder, well, why is he playing badly? And it's got nothing to do with his swing. It's more to do with his family life and what's going on.
Mm. Fionn, on the George Floyd situation, PGA Tour, have they taken any steps?
Yeah.
It's very difficult for them.
I mean, is it?
Yeah, I think it is. I was talking to you briefly even before we came on air, and I was saying, like, even if we were on the board of the PGA Tour, to what extent would you feel you have the license or the authority, the moral authority, to take the lead on racial diversity? I mean, given everything,
I don't know. It's about taking the lead. Yeah, I don't know. It's about taking the lead.
Not taking the lead, but how strongly can they come out? What have they done in the last week, and what would you want from them?
Well, I would characterize the response as well-meaning but stuttering. You know, Jay Monahan has talked about opening up a dialogue, and Harold Varner III, who is one of the, well, I think he's one of two, but he's the only African-American player, if you consider Tiger as half African-American, half Thai, on the tour. And he wrote a letter, and Jay Monahan has welcomed this letter as the opening of a dialogue. There's a lot of this kind of talk around it. Excuse me. But what they've done is for the Charles Schwab is they have introduced an empty tea time. And that empty tea time is followed by a minute's silence that will then pay respect to the memory of George Floyd. And now
it's at 8:46.
It's at 8:46, which represents the 8 minutes and 46 seconds that Derek Chauvin held his knee on George Floyd's neck. And so you look at it and you go, okay, that's quite something. And then you kind of, I just had a quick look, and then I'm a bit confused because there are tee times at 8:45, Victor Hovland, Bryce Garnett, and Jason Duffner go out on the first. And at 8:45 off the 10th, Dustin Johnson, Justin Rose, and Bryson DeChambeau go off. So it's not really an empty tee time. It's just a minute after the 8:45 tee time. And again, I am not criticizing the intent of the gesture. But I would have question marks about this. So you're going off at 8:45, three players. Each player takes between 20, 30 seconds to put his ball down, take up a couple of practice swings and tee off. 8:46 will come and go, and the third player isn't even close to teeing off yet. So I'm just curious, would the player stop? Will one player tee off and then the other two players will stop, maintain the minute silence? That's something, again, I'm curious as to what is going to happen. So critics will say it's an empty gesture. I understand the 8 minutes 46 is symbolic and all the rest of it, but I just think, it's a little, yeah. I don't know. It's a little empty.
I take your point, but then it is a symbolic gesture. So if you get too deep into the weeds of the logistics,
sure,
it's a bit unfair. I mean, is 5 minutes gap enough? Do you leave an 8 minute 46 second gap till the next tee time? Like, where does it end?
Well, there's a 9 minute gap between tee times generally, but you're absolutely right. And it goes back to your earlier point, is that what are they meant to do? Are they meant to cancel events and, you know, everybody wear black armbands? Sure. I mean, I guess the point is this: we're talking about a sport that has not just not led the way, but has been so far back in the field,
sure,
when it comes to issues around race, around social injustice, so on and so forth. So in a sense, the PGA, and I'm going to give Jay Monahan absolute benefit of the doubt and say that, you know, if only for a PR exercise, he wants to make sure that they do the right thing. Mm-hmm. But they are being hoisted by their own petard. You know, this is an organization that has shown very poor form. And so, you know, I'm glad they're doing it. I'm glad they're at least acknowledging the moment. I think it shows, if anything, it's not even so much that that the PGA have like really good bona fides when it comes to issues like Black Lives Matter, etc., but that they are connected to what's actually going on in the world around or outside the golf bubble. I think that's really, that's what I'm hoping for, you know?
Yes, because they could easily have done
nothing.
Yeah.
They could easily have done nothing, just played.
We're going to take a short break for a moment, and then Andrew Coulthart is going to join us. So as mentioned, we're delighted to welcome him to the podcast. He should be walking the fairways of a European Tour event somewhere, but sadly, we're not quite at that stage. Andrew Coulthart, Ryder Cup player, European Tour player, European Tour winner, and now very much with Sky Sports, is with us. Andrew, thanks so much for making time. Great to have you with us.
Absolute pleasure. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having us.
That Scottish brogue is made for broadcasting. God damn you.
Yeah, I might have the fire, might have the voice, but not the face, eh? I thought I'd get that in before Peter says anything.
Don't worry, I'm not like Murph. I won't slag you that much.
Let's start with the key point. Just how grumpy was Peter Lawrie on tour?
I, I can't really sort of comment on that. it was probably a damn sight cheerier than I was most of the time.
is that right? Were you a touch grumpy yourself?
I was just born with a face. Like, you know, people used to say to me, you know, for God's sake, can you cheer up? I said, I'm absolutely perfectly happy. I was just born like this.
Roy Keane tells a story where his kid said to him, cheer up. And he said, I am happy. And the kid said, tell your face.
Yes, very good. Yes, that's a similar kind of phrase to one that my wife is using quite regularly these days.
So you, I presume, given the way golf shut down and then from a Sky Sports perspective, things shut down. Effectively, you retreated to home and have been very quiet for the last number of months, I presume.
That's right, yeah. 3 months off, being at home, which, it's initially quite tricky. I mean, it's great, obviously, that you get a chance to spend time with your wife and kids, no doubt about that. But you're so used to, you know, packing your bags every week, every other week or whatever, and being on the move. So it you're almost sort of institutionalized, actually, on tour life. So in the beginning, it's actually, you know, quite tricky to be in one place for one set of time. But the good thing about that is I know where all the pots and pans go now. I know, you know, I know how to make the bed properly. I know where to put the shoes and where to get them the next day. When my wife goes out and things like that. So I'm starting to fit in. Taking about 3 months, right enough.
That's very interesting. So I'm a home bird. I don't do much traveling. And we have Fionn there, who is a travel writer in his other profession, and we have Peter, who would have done a lot of travel as well. Do you get itchy feet as well, fellas, where you get used to traveling and there's a certain excitement with being on the move? Is that kind of relating to what Andrew's saying there?
Well, I should be in Vegas right now.
Okay.
My whole schedule has been shot to pieces. So I'd be enjoying the, whatever it is, 45 degrees of Vegas heat, maybe, you know, playing some dollar blackjack, going out to the Grand Canyon, stuff like that. Instead, I'm sitting at home in Stockport.
Right.
And, so,
Do you miss the travel, Peter?
Oh, I'm still not over it, yeah. Those hours that you used to spend on airplanes in complete and utter silence with maybe a your ear pods in or whatever else, I miss those days. You know, there was a lot of me time when I traveled, and now there's not so much me time anymore. And probably Andrew will equate to that. When you travel a lot, you have a lot of your own time. When you're at home, everybody gets in the way.
It's a real family man there, Peter Lawrie.
I've only been honest.
Yeah, definitely I get in the way. I know that for a fact.
Yeah.
One man in a house full of four girls, it's pretty tricky. Yeah, I don't miss the travelling because instead of being easier, it seems to have got harder, certainly the older I get. There is an awful lot of solitude, as Peter says. You can get quite lonely, particularly if you're playing and you've had a couple of bad rounds, you just sort of lock yourself away and don't even want to see anybody. But I do miss the crack. I miss the crack. I miss the guys. I miss the banter. I miss the leg pulling. I miss that aspect of it massively. And you know, hope, you know, when we get back out there again, I'm sure that'll continue, and there'll be several stories about this lockdown duration.
Do you still pick up the golf clubs and go out and play? What's your relationship like with the actual playing of the game these days?
Don't have one. Well, I'll play, let's see, I mean, last year I played about six times, year before about six times. I found the going very difficult towards the end of my career. It was having an effect on me as a person, my personality and stuff like that. And I didn't like the person I was becoming. I found it very difficult to deal with an awful lot of failure that was going on in front of me, which of course, you know, it was all down to me at the end of the day, but I was doing everything I possibly could to turn that into success. It wasn't happening. The game was evolving. Better players were coming in, and I found it very, very, very difficult. So I kind of fell out of love with the game, and I'm not ready to love it back yet.
What kind of person were you becoming? So I guess how you're feeling
even more miserable.
Yeah. I get on the 18 holes, you're fuming and it's not going well. But away from that, are you just eternally in a kind of grumpy, peeved mood?
Yeah, well, it's very difficult. I mean, it's like I try and equate it to somebody who works in a company in an office and they work their socks off morning, noon and night hoping to get that promotion. Guy comes in at the end of the year or the female boss comes in at the end of the year and says, yeah, I can see you've been working hard, but I'm going to promote them. And actually, you know, you're getting demoted. Okay, right, fine. You go away with your tail between your legs and you go and work harder and you go and work harder. You come back next year, given you're all spilling your guts, you've been demoted again. There's only a few people that can carry on dealing with that mentally as well as sort of physically before it has an impact on them. It was having an impact on me. It was impossible not to bring it home, looking into the eyes of my children, you know, finding it tough. And that's before we even start to talk about the economic impacts of it. You know, I had bills to pay, things like that. Not in a position now like Peter and I were in our early 20s where sponsors were, you know, were coming your way and providing money and funds that you were able to use for that. So it was now becoming your money. And of course, your money, it's your partner's money. And it's, you know, ultimately it's your kids' money. And, you know, you're throwing the equivalent of $2,000 down on the table at the beginning of every week and coming home with nothing. I defy anybody to have a smile on their face when that's happening after about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Peter, you're nodding.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree with you. You know, when I made my decision, it was more a case of, it was like any business. You know, I would have been better off, you know, staying at home as and doing a you know, minimum wage job, and I would have made more money than what I was earning on tour in my last probably year and a half. And you just say to yourself, well, any business, it just can't keep on going. You know, you have to make the decision. And, you know, you might as well, if you keep on going, you're only throwing bad money or, you know, good money after bad. And there's a time where you just have to say, and people used to say to me, oh, you're good enough to stay on. You should give it a go. You should keep going. And I go, no, I shouldn't. I said, I'm only, you know, chasing a dream that has now passed. You know, it's like a gambler. Going in and all of a sudden, you know, putting that his last 10 euros on the horse, thinking he's going to get back his 100 euros that he's lost, you know, a couple of hours ago, just doesn't work.
But I mean, is it also the case that for both of you, for many other professional golfers who found that they couldn't maintain the career right to the very end, is that in a sense, you're ill-prepared for that disappointment because at some point and for a long time, you were the best golfers you knew. And, you know, you have this God-given talent, this ability to do things that 99% of us could only dream of doing, and to kind of reach a point in the road where all of a sudden you're like going, right, it's not working for me. It's costing me money. It's costing me mental health. It's my self-esteem is in the toilet. Like, is there an issue? Like, how do you start coming back from that?
I that one to Andrew because I think I've been on the show talking about it quite a lot. So maybe Andrew, you can.
Okay. Yeah, it's very, very, very difficult. You need great family and friends round about you that help you. No, you're absolutely not prepared for that. At the end of the day, when you become a professional golfer, you know, you're a winner. You're probably winning 20-30% of the events you're entering. Then you become the small fish in the big pond. And although, you know, the spike is pretty positive, the graph is going great, you just can't believe where you are. You soak it all up and you love it. You absolutely love it. You love the first several years of being out there. Just the fact that you're playing is success, and you know, again, like I said, there's money there that you can use to help with your travel and accommodation and playing caddy. It doesn't take long before all of a sudden you realize it starts to become a job. And having invested 20 years, including your amateur days, your early professional days at this, there is nothing that prepares you for that sense of failure. You have to have a tremendous amount of self-esteem. You have to have a tremendous amount of confidence. That's the first thing that disappears. That all goes out the window. and you start to retreat massively inwardly yourself and physically, you know, within maybe some of the groups that you're traveling sort of out there with. And then, you know, then you have to come out of the room and you have to go and play and you have to go and compete. And we all start off with trying to hold on to any kind of positives that we have. And just as Peter said, you know, one of the toughest things was people saying, well, you know, you can do it, you know, so, you know, there's nothing stopping you. But the problem is all that did was just reinforced actually how far I had tumbled. So nothing prepares you for it. All of a sudden, the game has evolved. The players have evolved. You're no longer one of the best. You're propping up the field. It's not where you want to be. Again, as a winner, you want to be involved with the adrenaline of competing. It's not enough just to make up the field. And it becomes very, very difficult for most of us. I've been very fortunate. I managed to find this role at Sky, be given this role at Sky. I'm eternally grateful for that. That has helped massively. Peter, I'm not aware necessarily of the timeline with, you know, Peter moving into his role since he stopped playing, but being able to have another job. And luckily within the arena and the environment that we did at some point in our lives love, that is certainly something to hold on to. But if I really feel for these people that fall off the tour, that have nowhere to go. And as Peter alludes to as well, you can be in a vortex. You can be in a position where you actually can't pull yourself out of it. And it just breaks you down. It breaks relationships down. It breaks families apart. And it can be difficult. So, you know, I really feel for those people who have just had to go into another role that isn't even golf related and they haven't been prepared for.
We will get off this slightly negative. I don't know how we got into this.
But
we went deep early.
Things, yeah.
We went deep early. But you know, you had this as Fiona alluded to, this fantastic amateur career. You know, 87 Scottish Boys Amateur Championship winner, winning big titles in that as an amateur, turned pro 91 on the European Tour in 93, and a long old stint, 17 years on the European Tour. That is good going, and a Ryder Cup in the midst of it all. So you know, very, very successful. I was watching Ian Baker Finch's Open Chronicles the other evening on Sky. They're always really enjoyable and really well put together. And, you know, you forget with Ian Baker Finch, Open champion at 30, 31, retired at 36. You know, how quickly this game can go. How quickly, if your final European Tour year is 2010, Andrew, how quickly did your game go? Is it sudden decline, or was it ebbing for a few years, the big box coming on tour?
Yeah, no, it was starting to ebb for some time. You talk about that Ryder Cup. I was given a wild card to play in the Ryder Cup, and the story about the Ryder Cup has been told many times. Got that one game. I wanted to go out there and prove that I was more than worthy of a pick, that I could qualify automatically. So of course I, like Peter would have done, like we all have done, is just try to embark on incremental improvements. So I go, you know, out of my way trying to learn more about my swing. Big mistake. You know, practice in environments. In other words, becoming a bit of a range rat rather than be somebody that played all the time. And as a result of that, I lost enjoyment. So it was a gradual decline over several years, certainly probably about the last 8 or 9, where I really struggled. The confidence just was gradually shaven away, and the game, which once had been incredibly natural to me, and I was fortunate to be gifted at it, became consciously very, very difficult to operate. I had absolutely no faith in my golf swing. When that happens, and you give accountability to coaches, and your swing becomes their swing, you're lost.
And it's so very easy to happen. But you'd love to go back and say to yourself, Andrew, and I in particular, in this, if you go back in your career, there's times where you'd love to just shake yourself, like leave yourself now, go back, shake yourself and say, do X, Y, and Z, and don't do what you're just about to do, and your whole career will be different. And that's the way I looked at mine. I made some really stupid mistakes, and I really felt as Fiona had asked there a while ago, I thought I'd play golf forever. I thought I'd be the kind of the poor accountant and play into my 70s. And when that disappeared, as Andrew says, it takes an awful lot. And you're still not over it. It's like, as I would say, it's like a death in the family. That other person is always there somewhere. They're not there physically, but they're there mentally. Me as the golfer or Andrew as the golfer. And you just have to do something else then and as a different person.
Andrew, if you're not playing that much golf, you said yourself you played 6 rounds last year. Do you enjoy watching it?
Good question.
Your question is yes, Andrew.
Of course I enjoy watching it, particularly when I'm working at it. Yes! I can't get enough of it. Switching it on at 7 o'clock at night and sitting there right through till 11, 11.30, not missing a shot. Yes, it's wonderful. Again, it's golf is not a hobby. Golf is my job. So I put my time to researching as much as I can, on tours on both sides of the pond, in terms of what is happening, where we are, what's going to be happening in the future. Trying to stay abreast of as much of it as I possibly can because it's my job. Having said that, I also do enjoy watching Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Sure. As a broadcaster, then, what did you have to get good at very quickly? So what did you learn about broadcasting? Because I think it's a sphere we all probably underappreciate when we're just sitting at home watching on TV.
Well, sometimes just sort of being thrown in at the deep end, just sort of sink or swim, right, we're live now, get on with it. That was interesting. There was advice, but all of a sudden you go in front of the camera and you just have to fill that gap, hopefully with something that is, something that makes sense and is understandable. You obviously, in my role, you have to get used to an awful lot of people talking in your ear at various times and getting used to the cues. Mm. You have to, as a viewer, you have to understand that, potentially when it gets thrown down to me, I don't have 3.5 minutes to wax lyrical about what I've seen in front of me. Sometimes I've got 12 seconds, if that. And sometimes I've got 12 seconds and I don't even know they're going to be coming to me. So you have to be on your toes through the whole match. You have to be prepared for things to go wrong and you to be able to pick up. But having said that, they're all tremendous experiences that keep you on your toes and keep the excitement levels high.
Mm. You're generally out on course following matches, aren't you?
That's correct, yeah.
Is there much camaraderie there? Can you chat to the players off mic? What's the general atmosphere?
Yeah, generally, obviously, because I've played a bit, certainly when I, with some of the guys that I had played on tour with, some of the younger people don't even know who I am or what I did or whether I had a career or not. So they might find it slightly tricky. But I'm a professional golfer. I can determine when a player is approachable and when they're not approachable. Hmm. I can determine what, the types of character that are involved and how long it'll be before I potentially can go up and have a word with them. So I think that certainly one of the attributes I have as a past player is the empathy with professional golfers and what they're going through at those moments in time.
Mm. I saw relatively recently you presented Tiger with a little gift, a nod to Brookline. It was caught on camera and he cracked a smile and he was gracious. And I don't know, would Tiger have 2005 maybe have been as up for a moment like that? He seems to have genuinely softened, seems to be the reporting from people. I know we can only tell so much.
Yeah, that was actually a wind-up at my expense. That was Tiger giving me a gift.
Oh, sorry, was it?
Which Rich Beam had concocted the week before when he'd spoken to Tiger at the Tour Championships, which he subsequently won. Beamer had got this belt made up for me that had the Ryder Cup emblem on it. But he'd gone and got our singles result emboldened, tattooed on the belt. He was going to give it to me. And Tiger said, well, do me a favor, let me give it to him. And which he duly did. But yes, Tiger has matured. you know, a lot. He, goodness me, how long has he been out there? 20 years or so, numbers escape me.
23 years.
23, yeah.
He's, no, 24. 1996 he turned pro.
96. He's learned, you know, he's learned an awful lot. I've witnessed him at Ryder Cups in a vice captaincy role. I've not witnessed him at President's Cups, but he's softened a bit with the press. His life has been turned upside down. He's tried to get it again. He's kept his distance. He's opened up a little bit, for instance, with this, you know, contract that he's doing with, you know, Golf TV and things like that. Yes, I think Tiger's matured a lot. You know, he's got family. You know, these things do open your eyes a bit and do make you grow up. And Tiger has definitely become that. He's become a bit of a sort of father figure for some of the younger players on the PGA Tour. Yeah, he probably wouldn't necessarily have been that open when he was striving to be the best. And not only striving, maintaining that position at the top, which was just incredible, which he did, which he achieved. Something that we will probably never, ever see again. Maybe ever.
Yeah.
So, he is a bit more approachable. But trust me, when he feels he has a chance to win, when he feels he's in his office, he has got a great knack of absolutely closing that door, switching the lights out so that he himself can just be left alone to get on with his work.
Mm-hmm. Which is totally fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
It's part of the attraction, I think, of Tiger. I mean, Andrew, I don't know if you got to see the match, the Mickelson-Tiger, you know, the thing that was on a couple of weeks ago, but of the four, he seemed by far and away the most kind of focused on the task at hand. Like, I mean, he chatted a little bit, but not nearly as much as the others did.
I think that's the typical competitive instincts that the man has, doesn't it? You can't take that out of him, even for, you know, even for fun. I'm sure Peter's the same. I hate to go out on the golf course and not play well, even though I don't play anymore. So even though the game is for a laugh, the match was for a great, you know, a great cause, millions of people tuned in. Absolutely, Tiger still wanted to beat Mickelson. There's no doubt about that. And you know, when he had to switch it on, he would have done so.
Andrew, the two lads here, Nathan, or sorry, Fionn and Joe here, really enjoyed the match. And they came to me the other day and
don't say that in a sneery way as if we're that.
And I said, they asked me the same question and I said, no, I said it was a snooze fest. I turned it off. What was your opinion of the match, Andrew? As a player,
I don't like these questions, Peter. I thought it was wonderful tuning in to watch a pro-am. I thought it was great.
Damned with faint praise.
I thought it was, look, I think backing the digger up, it's been a terrible time throughout the world recently. You know, everybody's life has been affected by this. Just to finally get some form of golf on the television was great. And of course, as you know, Peter, golf is a tremendous vehicle for helping out charities and things like that. And that was a great opportunity to give something back to the real heroes who have saved so many lives and kept people alive and made people help people get better and things like that. So from that point of view, it was tremendous. You had two superstars of the golfing world with two incredible legends of the NFL. I guess if you weren't much of an NFL fan, there might not be something in it as well. I think it was incredible to see two people also that had been at the top of their game, how they still suffered from nerves when they had a golf club in their hand. But I take my hat off them too, because every time you take somebody out of their comfort zone, and I do say this to all the amateurs that I play with in pro-ams, you know, I admire them. If they put me outside of my comfort zone into an arena where thousands of people were watching, I'd be an absolute mess. So, you know, so these things were a lot of fun. They were a good laugh. It's nice to see the relationship with Mickelson and Woods sort of evolving. You know, they used to sort of hardly speak, and now they're pulling the leg of one another, you know, quite frequently. Mm. So from all that point of view, it certainly gave the watching public, you know, some hope, you know, and some excitement, something to look forward to and enjoy and talk about.
But you still thought it was a snooze fest, which is absolutely fine. You're perfectly.
That wasn't the answer I was looking for, Andrew.
Yeah, basically, you're the only grumpy one here, Peter.
What about the TV? I'm sure you're watching with your TV hat on as well. So we've talked about this last week. The players being mic'd up. Hey, what a cool thing for commentators to be able to talk to players on occasion during the round. I know it couldn't be replicated exactly like that in a tournament. Even carts. I mean, I would never advocate it for the majors, but for rank and file tour events, maybe there's something in speeding up the play a little bit. The television experience was very interesting if we're looking to broadcasting over the next 10, 20 years and making this, frankly, a product which appeals to people who are busy on their phones and have short attention spans the whole time. What about your TV hat? What did you make of the production?
Yeah, I thought that was very good. I thought the cameras, you know, the cameras and mics inside the carts, you know, where they can hear the sort of offhand comments. It's certainly something that everybody will be looking forward to, as you said, to future productions. The interesting thing about, again, it was for a laugh. Mm. It was for fun. So, you know, they weren't taking it completely seriously. The idea of microphones is interesting because, you know, you are in your office. Not everybody has an office and a microphone in their office. You do have personal private conversations with your caddies that go on. And of course, anything that is spoken with the potential of a live mic can be recorded somewhere. Although the information will be good as to how they speak, I fear it might sort of sterilize it a little bit. You won't get the true individual coming out because at the last minute, he'll always be aware that the whole world has the potential to listen to this. Mm-hmm. You know, you won't see the odd sort of head offs and maybe the expletives that would go along with it. And these are all things. Certainly, I laugh with the players when they do that because I know exactly what it feels like and I know exactly the pain they're going through. Mm. But all that kind of stuff potentially would be wiped out. But speed of play, there were certainly a few things there that television companies will look forward to in the future. We're talking this week, for instance, at Colonial about interviewing players on the golf course. That's a policy that the European Tour have adopted for about the last 3 or 4 years, which I think has been incredibly successful.
Yes.
You do need a special person on the course to be asking the right questions, and the questions are limited. Yeah. With the direction that you've got to go in. But you know, those kind of things are very welcome as well. That gives a tremendous insight to the watching public as to what the player is thinking inside the ropes between shots.
Has the bosses at Sky given you any indication of what your work life will be like over the coming months in terms of when you finally get back out onto a course? Will there be changes? Any intimation of like what your work experience will be like?
Not exactly, not yet. They're still, you know, factoring these situations in. There's various suggestions on the go, but at the moment at European Tour venues, the amount of bodies moving around the place will be severely restricted to enable, you know, the maximum use of space that is needed to keep this virus at bay and things like that. So everything's being looked at, but at the minute I've had no specific information as to how the broadcasting policy in conjunction with the tour policy is going to move forward. That's I think things are still very fluid at the moment. Keep one eye on the ground, so to speak, and one eye on the virus and seeing where it's at and keeping an eye on the R numbers and stuff like that to hope that a second spike certainly doesn't materialize.
Andrew, you're talking to a golf podcast here, golf audience. A lot of people who play a lot of golf are into the intricacies of the game. If you can remember, when you were playing your best golf and you said that you had a very natural swing, could you give us a sense of how you went about your business? I.e., did you tend to favour a draw, a fade? What was your big miss? Did you feel like your hands were very active, not very active? How, when you were swinging the club well, what was your modus operandi? What were your go-to things?
One of the things was it was just natural. I was in a position where pretty much most of the time I could just focus on where I wanted the ball to go. That changed enormously and went right into where I wanted the club head to be.
Right.
As a result of that, the ball never went where I wanted it to go. So when I was sort of in that zone, it was very, very lucid. And again, Peter will be able to attest this. You felt like you could play the game with one hand tied behind your back. You felt like you were never going to miss a cut and you were going to coin it in for years. And then all of a sudden, you know, I started to become more conscious about my swing. I heard other players talking about the swing who were higher up the rankings. They seemed to know an awful lot about it. I thought that's the way I had to go down. And it all sort of backfired. But it was mainly just, you know, where did I want the ball to go? Focus on that. And pretty much was just all about rhythm.
So you visualized the shot and the body responded almost.
I just thought that's where I want the ball to be. I had a great picture in my mind of the target that I was trying to head into, and I never thought about my golf swing.
Because Rory McIlroy spoke recently, Peter, and he was saying the one thing he wants to guard against is playing backswing golf, i.e. looking back over your shoulder at the position the club is in. That's a recipe for disaster.
Well, he's one of the most natural golfers out there, isn't he? And the less that he can think about it, and the more that he plays, especially with the putter, he'll do so much better than he is currently. But there again, I'm always told that Rory's doing great and his stats are this and his position is this. I just think he's as good as Tiger and could putt as well as Tiger did in his era if he kept to a schedule where he played quite a bit, because I don't think he's the type of player that needs a break. He needs to keep a rhythmical way of playing and a less sort of tension or focus on his putting method rather than the ability to get the ball in the hole.
Yeah. Andrew, here's a question you can go no comment on. Absolutely. Matt Kuchar. What was that about? I didn't understand that situation at all. Especially a fellow pro, it's a relaxed situation and it's a quick 1 minute. Matt, how you doing? Yeah, it's great. Great to be here in the UK. That's all you're looking for, clearly.
Yeah, well it was a very relaxed situation because he was playing a shot from the next tee down to the previous green. It wasn't a shot that he was, at least I can't imagine it was a shot that he was expecting to play in the tournament. The group in front were within range. I'd already spoke to his playing partner, Mark Leishman, who's one of the best guys from Australia. He's one of the best guys out there on tour. And of course, we were live. And I was then going to go on and describe the hole. But my instructions were to have a chat to anybody who's here. Leishman was absolutely perfect. Matt wasn't doing anything that he was really sort of going to be doing in the tournament. I understand that, obviously, as an ex-player. So I asked him a question. And he really didn't have much to say about it, really. So then I had to just carry on talking about the hole. It was quite interesting.
Yeah, but I didn't even acknowledge your presence, almost. Like, fair enough, he looked. It was just bizarre. And you know you're live. He probably doesn't.
Well, I think if he turned around and acknowledged, if he turned around and looked at me, I'd have probably carried on going. I'd have carried on speaking to him, trying to, but he didn't want to give eye contact, and I thought it was quite amusing.
Yeah. Have you seen him since?
Yeah, I've seen him since. I think also as well, I think it's fair to say that the general public has seen an awful lot more of Matt Kuchar since that. I've seen him since, and I tried to sort of say, you know, what was all that about? And you know, he was just he just gave a very sort of typically smiley sort of apologetic type shrug of the shoulders. It was just a misunderstanding type thing.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I mean, you make the point is that, like, before all of that happened, before the incident with you, before the Mayakoba stuff, it's like the general consensus on Gooch would have been really positive. And then all of a sudden, in the space of what, less than 12 months, it went like, oh, not that much of a fan. I'm not that much of a Matt Kuchar fan really anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you realize that there's an awful lot of people out there on tour who seem one way in front of a camera, who are, you know, and you've heard stories, who are completely different off camera. So it's not, you know, it's no surprise. You know, at the end of the day, as a golfer, you know, you have to be a bit of an actor in so much as you have to act that you believe you're going to win this event. You have to act that you believe that you're better than everybody else. You have to be very, very cognizant of your public persona and the character you are and how you are observed by the people viewing and watching when the cameras are on. So, you know, there are instances of people who are, you know, the complete spectral opposite, if you like, of that once the cameras go down. Not going to name any names before somebody asks.
It's all right, Andrew. I've been teaching these guys off air who's nice and who's not.
You've done it on air. Our lawyers have had to chop you.
It's the classic thing of the David Simses, you know, the Don Johnson character from Tin Cup. I mean, of course, we all know, and I appreciate you're not going to name names. Maybe can I ask you a question that kind of flips that? Who are the newer generation of players that really impress you?
Obviously. Funnily enough, it's sort of like Scandinavian guy. That Hovland is incredible. The Højgaard twins are also incredible. Matt Wolf, I like immensely because he swings it his way. Mm. Bit like Jim Furyk did, but a lot longer. Rather than conforms to what some people would see as a norm. I love that. Colin Morikawa. This kid is sensational. He's come straight out on tour. I think he's played 20 events on tour and he's earned world ranking points in every single one, which is something I think that in the modern era no golfer has even achieved, even likes a Tiger or Rory in that stretch of events. So keep an eye on him. I think we're about to see a change in golf from the point of view we're going to see much more individual styles, more individual approaches. You know, we're going to see a lot of exciting players and the game will be in good hands. I do still want to harp on about the fact, and I don't know Peter's feelings about it, I do still want to harp on about the fact that distance, though, I think is... It's reducing the character of players, the ability for players to cultivate shots. I need it to step away from... you know, this crash and gouge type thing. And you know, I want to be able to players to understand how to hit it low, high, left to right, right to left. That type of thing is not required these days. And instead of building golf courses that reduce that advantage, they're building golf courses that only accommodate it.
Yeah.
I'm totally with you there. I say it all the time, Andrew. We're talking about, you know, even this week's golf courses in Colonial is it's not a bomber's paradise. You have to be able to shape it. And that's the way golf courses should be, rather than the next step is they're going to build 8,000-yard golf courses. So it's just wrong and something has to be done. But typical, the powers to be are always slow to act.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Peter, because I think also that this – huge issue we've got with slow play. If you have a longer golf course, you're going to have longer hours. You know, you're going to have more balls being lost and things like that. So, you know, and obviously land comes at an expense. Then you've got to, you know, fertilize it. You've got to grow it. You've got to water it. You've got to cause all these other ecological issues that are related to it. Come on, shorten the golf courses. Get them back down to under 7,000 yards. Let everybody have the opportunity to go out there and have fun. And not get their heads caved in by just a brutal golf course that takes 8 hours out of your life each day.
Typical media. I brought you to Matt Kuchar. I think Fionn tried to kind of nod towards it as well. Who are the good personalities on tour? Who are the guys you think? Oh, I'm in their featured group. Great. These are good, solid, really sound fellas.
Fowler's a fantastic kid. McIlroy's incredible because as Peter says, he's Tiger. But without switching everybody off, do you know what I mean? You can he's approachable. He wants to have a chat with you when you're out there.
That is extraordinary because I'd say everyone wants to have a chat with him.
Yeah, I think it's probably. I mean, you know, we've Peter and I, we've played a bit with Rory, you know, so you know he knows us from that point of view. It's slightly different from people who he only sees in the media tent. Who else? Yeah, sort of throwing that one out there. Slightly different generation now. I mean, one guy that I, and it's not just because you guys are Irish, but one guy who I always thought was fantastic, who never changed. You might know better, but I grew up playing golf with him and against him, was Padraig Harrington. Harrington, I think for what he's achieved, he's managed to keep his feet fairly firmly on the ground. Lowry's good crack. Goodness me, it seems to be an awful lot of Irishmen.
We're just the best here, are we?
Yeah, I know. Everybody's starting to vomit now.
Earlier on, I paid tribute. I was saying that I've become a huge Justin Thomas fan just based on his media performances. Yeah. Am I correct?
I think Thomas is also good. I think what you've got to counter with that is, though, again, the career's going like that.
Yeah.
The graph is going very high. You know, these players that I've spoken about, they're players that even when it's not going well, will still talk to you. And that's, you know, that to me is the real sort of test as to who understands it.
Yes.
Who's very pragmatic and who's realistic. Mm. Even when they're having tough times, they still have no problem about chatting. I'm still trying to think about some of the players.
Thomas Bjorn should be there, top of your list, no?
Thomas, you've just got to look at that brow that starts off from the right-hand side of his right eye and goes all the way across to the left eye. And you've got to figure out if there's a dip in the middle or if there's a crest, it's possible to go and have a chat to him. If there's a dip, then stay well away from him.
How is Scottish golf, Andrew? Is there talent coming through? Is the game being played?
There is. There is some talent coming through. Obviously, Conor Syme has touched the European Tour golf courses. He's just dipped back into the Challenge Tour, but we'll be back out, I think, in the European Tour in the near future. Goodness me. Ewan Ferguson, who's a young lad who's still off the roundabout the Challenge Tour at the minute, but obviously I'm pretty sure he'll come through. Obviously, you've got the big lefty up there from Oban. He's absolutely fantastic. He was pushing the boundaries for Ryder Cup this year, although expectations, it's got to manage them. Very dangerous to think too far into the future and then put an awful lot of pressure on himself. So that's something that Robert's going to have to watch. Who else? Missing somebody.
And is it as popular amongst the general public? Like, it's such phenomenal tradition and courses and everything else. Is it still like a real Scottish game that people play and golf courses are doing well?
Well, very much so. But no, I think everybody's suffered, you know, with the economic times that we've been going through. Excuse me. Obviously, this hasn't helped. Golf clubs and courses being in lockdown. Money's become a massive issue, not just for players wanting to play golf, but for golf courses and clubs able to maintain those courses and stay alive. Some golf courses, of course, rented the land that they played on, and the landowners want them back and have taken some back to develop properties on and things like that. So it's definitely trying times for the golfing industry, but little sort of green shoots sort of appearing off the back of being allowed back out to play from lockdown. There seems to be a big interest in people desperate to get back out the house for whatever reason I can't understand, and hit a few golf balls again.
Pretty good. Well, listen, we've taken up more than enough of your time. Thanks so much for coming on and chatting through a whole host of things with us. So I guess the plan for you is pretty soon get back out. There's these six events on the European Tour, so I presume Sky will cover them in some shape or other, and hopefully we get back to normal.
Sure will, yeah. Fingers crossed. Hopefully everybody can stay safe, stay healthy, and stay happy. But thanks for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Good to see you, boys.
Andrew Coulthart. Thanks.
Cheers, Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew.
All the best, guys. See you later, chaps.
There we are. Andrew Coulthart with us, European Tour player, now very much on Sky Sports, doing his thing.
He's great.
Great fella, yeah. And always, you know, I will fire out texts to plenty of people and they don't always get back. He always does, even when he can't do it, which is always one of those polite signs that... understandably, people don't always have the time to be polite, but he always does. So, yeah, really good to have him on. And I'd say, Peter, pro golfers, Matt Kuchar aside, but in the main, if they see Coulthard coming towards them, I would say they're more likely to be amenable than they might be to most, because they know he gets it.
Yeah, I didn't want to ask him there, especially, you know, as it's gone out on Sunday. But did he find that being in the commentary box now kind of alienates him a little bit from the actual goings on of the players?
Yeah, sure.
I certainly know I have found it that even just doing this, you know, the Golf Weekly podcast, guys that would have been very open with me are a little bit more cagey now.
Really?
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And I find that, like, it's not as if I'm coming on the show and saying anything, you know, about anybody in any kind of personal manners.
No, sure.
But they're gone. You mean quite cagey?
You mean cagey from the perspective of their personal life and who might be going out with who, or who, what's going on in terms of people's life away from the course, or in terms of, like, even just their game and who's playing well on the range?
Just in general, a bit of both. That they're minding, you know, when you're talking to somebody and you know that they're minding their P's and Q's, and that's what I get. That's what I feel.
Interesting.
And yeah,
you're on the you've crossed enemy lines now, Peter.
Oh, I'm well and truly, yeah. I'm unfortunately have fallen into the trenches and come out the other side.
I mean, your point is well reflected. I remember reading, one of the kind of aging golf writers in America who was saying that, you know, in the 60s when he was a young Cub reporter and he'd go to the Masters and you'd happily chat to the players, they'd tell you all kinds of stories and reveal all kinds of secrets with the unspoken understanding that as a journalist, you would never reveal them because that's what gentlemen did. You know, they spoke to each other, and that a journalist knew what was for public consumption and what was strictly just for private knowledge. And he bemoaned the fact that that players have lost that trust in journalists today, which is a terrible shame, because I'd like to think that I don't think any of us would ever reveal a confidence, you know, just simply to get likes or clicks or whatever it is.
No, but I'm sure the players would say, well, the trust has been broken. It only takes a couple of people to do it for
that's it. Yeah,
players to understandably say, well, the safer option here is that I don't, you know, I have enough people to talk to. I don't need to have journalist friends on top of everything else, which I totally get. If I was a player,
so I
would be telling journalists nothing, frankly. I would.
Joe, there again, you lose then the... You lose telling people your what you're actually like. Nobody can actually see then what you're like. If you don't trust people who are close to you, then you go into this.
I'm very sorry to interrupt.
This cocoon, like Tiger did.
Well, yeah. Although I would say, social media has circumvented journalism. Like, if you, Peter, now were coming on the scene and you're a hot shot and you're on the Twitter and the Instagram, and you have, you know, I think Rory has 4 million Twitter followers. I think, you know, they're all kind of Instagram, literally done millions, and they're your core fan base. Why would you need a journalist to reflect your personality through a newspaper article when you can just, on a daily basis?
Yeah, sure. You circumvent the media and you just go directly to your followers.
Direct control. You get to present an image, false or not. You get to totally control how people see you. You get to interact with people. You get to do a gazillion other things. And it's one of the tough aspects of journalism now that one maybe thing you could offer players, which was a degree of profile and it can communicate your narrative or your story, that is no longer such a selling point. It's really, really interesting point in golf media relations, sports media relations, I suppose, as well, yeah. Peter, you know?
It's also kind of reflected. I don't know if either of you saw that Ipsos Mori poll about trustworthiness and where journalists came in, 42% of people told the journalists told the truth, which is a ways behind government ministers who are at 47%. Yes. So journalists are less honest in the general public's eye than government ministers. But here's an interesting one is that news readers hit a 77% on the honesty mark. But like, where do you think news readers get their news from? Journalists. Anyway, I just thought it's not a good time for journalists.
No, it's hard to think of a we're moving up the ladder of least popular professions, I would think.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's time to find a new job, lads.
Well, I come to that regardless.
Speaking of journalists, is one of my favorite golf guys, Michael Bamberger, who I go on and on about.
I'm trying to nag him to come on the podcast at the moment, actually.
Are you? Yeah. It's funny. He'd be a great one, I think, because he has plenty of stories. But he wrote, so he's at the Charles Schwab at the moment, and in golf.com. He writes so beautifully. I think that's why I'm such a fan. And anyway, but his observations, I'll just read you this. Some players and caddies, as they gathered on the first tee or the 10th tee at the start of a practice round, made no effort to keep 6 feet apart. Likewise, some players and caddies were handing clubs back and forth as they normally would. They're outside in a hot wind. Nobody has ever confused tournament golf with meal distribution at a nursing home. Around the clubhouse and the club's traditional milling areas, there was one instructor wearing his mask around his left upper arm, like an old school USGA arm bandage. A few caddies wore them. The players did not.
Yeah. It's going to happen. I would presume they are all of the opinion that we've all been tested so much.
That's exactly it. And he does make that point. The testing is very rigorous. You get tested as you arrived. And all of the tests that were done of caddies, players, etc., none of them came back positive. Only four on the Corn Ferry Tour came back this week as positive. Okay. So, yeah, absolutely. It's within that context that once you've come inside the bubble,
yeah,
you can kind of act as if because, yeah, we're all good.
But, I thought they're giving out about where the caddies are staying, and the caddies are not staying where they should be staying. They're staying where they want to stay.
There's four hotels that are being used, but there's players who are staying in rented accommodation. You know, I mean, it's something in my own private life, we were just discussing just the everyday norms of going to the shops or the soup. And it's like, yes, there are regulations that are being suggested, but it's like, how do you make alterations to your life that are so antithetical to everything you've ever known that there's always going to be a bit of slippage? I'm not excusing not maintaining social distancing regulations at all, but I do understand that, you know, it's everyone's, I guess, I like to think that everybody's doing their best, and sometimes, you know, whatever.
None of us are perfect. That's for
exactly
sure.
Exactly.
Fellas, let's wrap it up there. Fiona, as ever, thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Peter Laurie, the Spawell driving range is very much open.
Thanks, Joe.
As it would appear, is the club repair shop on site as well, which is
yeah.
Peter, thanks cheers. So much. Thanks so much. We will talk to you next week. We'll have a tournament review, amongst other things. So thanks, fellas.
Happy days. Thanks. Bye.